And welcome back. I am Lizzie, your Millennial Movie Matchmaker. First and foremost, I hope that everybody had a great holiday season and that we are all ramping up for a new year. Whether or not you subscribe to the New Year, New Me mantra, at least hopefully we can all agree that we are ready for a new year. So here's hoping. All right, so what are we going to be talking about today? Well, Wonder Woman 1984. That's right. This is the highly anticipated sequel to the first Wonder Woman movie starring the lovely and enchanting Gal Gadot. And I have got to say that I was really, really excited for this movie. But of course, this being a superhero movie, we're first going to talk about my top five favorite superhero movies. This is, I say this every episode, but it is a huge undertaking. There's so many. I mean, even just in the MCU alone, there are like 23 different movies. That's not even talking DC. That's not even talking X-Men, since technically that's not a part of it. There's so many different options, but I love superhero movies. I've been racking my brain on as to why I think that we all love superhero movies so much. And I really think that it's because the fact that it hyperbolizes the formula of good versus evil, right? You know, the good person isn't just good. They have superpowers, and the evil isn't just evil. They want to destroy the entire world. And so you're really over-exaggerating these normal formulas that would be in a drama, but usually there's always some kind of fun love story. There's a ton of action. These superhero movies tend to encapsulate a little bit of everything with respect to why we like going to the movies. You know, if you look at some of the highest grossing movies of all time, superhero movies are truly way up there. So I think regardless as to where you lie with DC versus Marvel, if you're into the Avengers, if you're not, if you're more of an X-Men person, regardless on where you lie on the spectrum, I think that there is absolutely a superhero movie for you. All right, so before we dive in to my top five, let's first talk about my honorable mention. So quick reminder, that is a movie that is either not on my list, but I have a deep-rooted respect for it, so I gotta talk about it, or it's just so terrible that I gotta talk about it and we need to have a good laugh. All right, so without further ado, my honorable mention for today is going to be The Green Lantern. I doubt that many of you were surprised. This movie will always go down in history as one of the absolute worst superhero movies of all time. Now, this was teed up to be wildly successful. This movie has a juggernaut of a cast. I mean, you've got Ryan Reynolds, Blake Lively, Peter Sarsgaard, Mark Strong, Jeffrey Rush provides his voice. I mean, truly, the list goes on and on. It has the same director as Casino Royale. I think that the players were all lined up perfectly, but somewhere along the way, they just missed the mark completely. I was doing a little bit of research to try to figure out what went wrong. First and foremost, the director of the movie really wanted Bradley Cooper, but the studio, so it was done by Warner Brothers, and they wanted Ryan Reynolds. They wanted that Van Wilder cockiness that to bring to the role of Hal Jordan. And so they went ahead and cast him behind the director's back. So I think that was strike number one. That obviously created a little bit of tension between the director and Ryan Reynolds. The second piece is that the movie was entirely edited by the studio. So they really kept the entire team, the producers, the director, everything was really kept hush hush. And unfortunately, so much was left on the cutting room floor that my big issue with this movie is it's so choppy and so over edited that they really did completely sacrifice character development on this. I have said it once, I'll say it again. Character development is key in any genre, but especially in a superhero movie. You know, we want to be able to understand what this character has gone through. You know, of course, when it's their first movie, especially, you know, you want to watch their journey. Save them just being a superhero for the sequel. That is why there are 23 different Marvel movies. They have put in the work to get you to Endgame. But I, unfortunately, Green Lantern, you know, they spent like 2 minutes on Hal's backstory, and then it just so okay. To go ahead and start from the beginning. So it focuses around Hal Jordan, and he, again, they take a minute and a half at best to talk about his backstory. And he's been friends with Carol and Hector, who are brother and sister, his whole life. And it turns out that Carol and Hal are fighter pilots. And of course, Hal, played by Ryan Reynolds, brings this. Basically, he's the exact same character in everything. I mean, he will always be Van Wilder, whether he is in a green CGI suit or a red and black suit as Deadpool or anything in between. He is always, always Ryan Reynolds. He's just one of those actors that plays himself in every role. And honestly, it works. It works for him. But so he's very cocky, and he, you know, it shows him right off the bat. He's doing things he shouldn't be doing up in the air. They tell him that he's fired, and he says, you know, it's actually too late because I quit. Side note, I why not just allow yourself to be fired and take the severance? Just a thought. But anyway, so that really sets the tone for Hal's personality. He's a quitter. And while this is happening, you are seeing that up in space there is a galactic battle from this evil being called Parallax. Now, I guess to give you a little bit of genesis about the Green Lantern world, there is the power of will, so that's represented by the color green, and there are these essentially space cops that are all they all have harnessed the power of will, and they protect worlds against fear. So fear is represented by the color yellow, and this evil alien named Parallax has harnessed fear, and at one point he was captured and put into a space jail, but he has since broken free. He's destroyed a bunch of worlds, and in the process of destroying said universes, he blows off a spaceship, and that spaceship just so happens to crash land onto planet Earth, and as more or less right in Hal Jordan's lap. Now, Hal, of course, goes over to investigate, and I would say this scene is very Santa Claus starring Tim Allen adjacent in the fact that, you know, of course, you know, you put on the suit, you become the big guy. Same concept. He takes the ring that this dying space alien is wearing, and he takes it for himself. He puts it on, and little does he know that the ring has now chosen him, and he is now one of these Green Lantern characters. You know, he in a trance at one point he says the sacred oath. You know, the brightest day and blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight, and his skin changes, and this is where people start to get really upset, is that his suit is not actually a suit, it's become his skin, and it's very aesthetically bothersome. I mean, it's he's a lot skinnier than he is before. I mean, it's very clear that they have used so much CGI in this movie. And so he, you know, he goes up into space and he meets a couple of characters, and they decide to go ahead and train him to become a Green Lantern. Now, my piece that I have an issue with this movie as well is just with the fact that, again, they really sacrificed so much on character development. You know, you've got such a huge opportunity. So up in space, you have got Sinestro, who is played by Mark Strong, and he's essentially his mentor. So he explains to him that the key to harnessing will is to eliminate all fear. You know, it's kind of very Jedi adjacent. And the training scene is so anticlimactic. I mean, literally, he fights with his trainer, Kilowog, played by a amazing Michael Clark Duncan, rest in peace. And you know, it lasts 2 minutes. He comes back, Sinestro checks in, and Michael Clark Duncan's Kilowog's character goes, can I train him or can I train him? Well, Kilwog, you didn't train him. You just kicked the shit out of him for 2 minutes. There was absolutely no depth to that scene whatsoever. And honestly, that's really how a lot of the movie goes. So Parallax makes his way to Earth and he gets his claws into Hector, played by Peter Sarsgaard. And of course, it takes over him. He becomes a bad guy, completely overridden by fear. But my issue with it, Peter Sarsgaard is amazing. I mean, he's a phenomenal actor, but my issue with him and his character is his arc isn't earned. It's not earned. Like, I don't care that he is like this. I don't feel sorry for him. I don't feel like he deserves redemption, which, by the way, he doesn't get. And it just, to me, this movie just, it took an amazing cast, an amazing director, and a really amazing concept, and just gave it all lights and glitter and CGI and absolutely no depth, no heart, nothing. And so honestly, to me, the best thing that came out of this movie was the courtship between Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively, because I gotta say, I love that couple. I love the way that they troll each other on the gram, and honestly, that I guess in a way that's worth it. But they were going to make it was supposed to be a trilogy, and after just the catastrophic review, so I think they spent $200 million on this movie, and it made $219 million, which is the absolute definition of a flop. All right, so moving on to my top five favorite superhero movies of all time. I'm so excited about this. This is actually one of my favorite all-time genres. And this is a throwback. It is in my favorite, possibly because more of nostalgia than anything else. But to me, I would categorize a favorite in the fact that I could watch it at any point in time, no matter what kind of day I'm having. It's not one of those movies that I have to get into, no, regardless of what's happening around me. If I'm going to watch this movie, I'm going to be excited. And that is absolutely, this movie is absolutely that for me. And it is Batman Forever. Now, this is the first Batman movie of the original four that was not directed by Tim Burton. It has a new Batman. So previously in Batman and Batman Returns, you have Michael Keaton is your Batman. And this one, Val Kilmer in all of his glory. So this doesn't really have any kind of correlation. They never mentioned the first two movies. So honestly, this kind of stands on its own 2 feet. To be fair, they kind of all do. But this, so again, you've got Val Kilmer is your Bruce Wayne, and the movie kind of picks up very quickly. I mean, it hits the ground running. You've got a Two-Face played by the iconic Tommy Lee Jones. He does an amazing, amazing Two-Face. He's very campy and fun, but that's what these movies were. You know, these were not Christopher Nolan movies. These originally, the first two were directed by Tim Burton, the man behind A Nightmare Before Christmas. I mean, so there has to be some level of camp. And Harvey, you know, of course, he has it out for Batman. The whole beginning scene is just this very dramatic ruse to try to kill Batman. And of course, he's unsuccessful. And then from there, the entire plot begins. So you have Bruce Wayne, he's checking up on Wayne Enterprises, and it is there that you were introduced to Edward Nygma, played by Jim Carrey. And just like I had said that, you know, Ryan Reynolds is the kind of character who was always playing himself, Jim Carrey, at least up until this point, was exactly the same. I mean, he hadn't done, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or you know, some of his other more serious movies. But up until then, movie came out in 1995. He had done Ace Ventura, The Mask, and Dumb and Dumber. And that was really it. So he was absolutely the same person through and through. But I can't imagine anybody else doing it. I did a little bit of research, and it does turn out that they had wanted Robin Williams to be the Riddler. Now, anybody that knows me knows that I have such a soft spot for Robin Williams. Everyone in the entire world disagrees with me, but I think he looks like my dad. He reminds me of my dad. His essence does. I swear I've never cried harder over a human being that I have never met before than I did when he passed. But I hold such a near and dear place to my heart. And I actually think that he could have potentially been good, but I think that the kooky crazy that Jim Carrey brings was phenomenal. But the reason why Robin Williams didn't play this was apparently Warner Brothers used Robin Williams as bait for the original Batman movies. So they tried to get him to get into talks of playing the Joker in order to lure in Jack Nicholson, in a way of saying, we've got lots of big names. Robin Williams is even considering this in order to get Jack Nicholson to be a little bit more enticed to accepting the role. And when Robin Williams found out, he was absolutely infuriated and he said that out loud publicly that he would never work with Warner Brothers again when they had the audacity to reach out to him and ask his permission to, or to see if he would accept this role. He essentially told them to, go fly a kite. So here we are. He wants to introduce this tool called the box. Now, the box is going to be able to create a virtual reality experience so that you can feel like you are inside the television. Now, in the beginning, he is just, it seems like a pretty innocent idea. But in order to do it, he has to be able to manipulate the brain waves in order to make the brain see something that isn't there. Bruce doesn't get behind this. He says, and I quote, "There's just too many questions," which leaves Nygma completely just baffled. In his mind, he had created this narrative that he and Bruce were on the same page, that there was absolutely no way that he was going to say no. This kind of leads him to snapping. He goes off on his boss. He makes his boss the first guinea pig of a human trial. And it is there that he discovers that not only is he able to manipulate the subject's brain waves, but he's also able to make their brain waves enter into his brain, allowing him to absorb their knowledge. So essentially it's like a brain drain, if you will. And so he just kind of goes down this downward spiral, becomes crazier and crazier. Now, while this is all going on, Bruce develops an attraction to Chase Meridian, played by Nicole Kidman. This was right around the time that she had filmed To Die For. She is absolutely stunning. She's so sexy. She plays Chase Meridian. She's a abnormal psychologist. Or excuse me, psychiatrist, because she's a doctor. She has been around Batman many times, and now she is very forward that she is into the Batman. I mean, every single time she sees him, she's making some kind of sexual innuendo, and it's very steamy and very sticky. She is not shy about the fact that she wants him in her bed, and so she completely denies any of Bruce's advances. I'm going to fast forward really quickly and then we'll snap back. Of course, she eventually gives in to Bruce, and but not before giving the Batman a big passionate kiss. So, as you can imagine, a mask is not going to completely disguise his identity once you've given him a good smooch. So, she eventually learns that he's Batman, but up until this point, she still doesn't know. He's finally able to break her down. They end up going on a date. He takes her to the circus, and it is just like you would imagine. All they need is Australia's sweetheart, Hugh Jackman. This is the greatest show. I mean, it's just as gaudy and campy as in that movie. And as they're enjoying the show, they see that there are these amazing family of trapeze artists, and they're doing their thing. They're flipping and flopping in the air. Who should show up but Two-Face? And he comes in guns a-blazin' and ends up taking out a bunch of innocents, including the majority of this trapeze family, and leaving one sole survivor. Now, Bruce, being the gentleman that he is, opens up his home to this young man. And it is then that we are introduced to Dick Grayson, played by Chris O'Donnell. And as they're putting away his clothes, Alfred notices that he has a picture of, you guessed it, a robin on his helmet. It is because he swung in like a robin, saved his brother at one point. And Chris is absolutely what you would call at the time a bad boy. You know, he wears a leather jacket and he's into all these motorcycles and he's just obsessed with, you know, what is behind this door? What is behind this door? And I can't quite figure out if Alfred is trying to get him to discover it or not because, you know, there's a scene in the movie where, you know, he's explains this where the silver is, don't worry about it. Then he calls up to Robin. You know, Master Grayson, and he comes out to see what's going on. He's got that door wide open, and Alfred says, "You know, I'm just checking." And he very slowly walks out. And of course, Robin can't, you know, he can't resist going to get it. But it feels to me like it was all some big ruse to get him to check it out. And what further makes me feel that way is that he goes down, he slides down into the bat cave, and when he lands, there is Alfred staring him down and gives him this kind of nod as if to say, you know, welcome to the bat cave. You finally discovered it all and have at it. Well, it isn't too much longer while this is happening that Dr. Chase Meridian and Bruce Wayne are finally getting their moment. You know, she's been all about Batman this whole time. And after hearing a little bit of Bruce's childhood trauma, she's thinking, you know, this guy's just fucked up enough for me to be into. Because that is the thing about Chase, right? She's only into the Batman because she's absolutely fascinated as to why a grown man would dress up like a bat and run about town in a fancy car and a utility belt, right? I mean, that's a little crazy. So she's into the crazies. So they're having their moment. And what just makes me confused about the Alfred piece is that Alfred calls in a panic saying that Robin has stolen his car. But, you know, Alfred, what else would you have expected him to do? I'm going to take the Batmobile if I go out and see it, which I don't. I love. So he takes the Batmobile. He goes out downtown. And one thing that I love about these older movies is that like the downtown or like the Skid Row area, if you will, is filled with all of these characters with their faces painted and it's blacklit. And so it's just so gaudy and absolutely hilarious. So the plot carries on. Edward Nygma has coined the name the Riddler. He is all about giving a good, confusing riddle, and he sends them to both Bruce Wayne and to Batman because, you know, at this point, of course, he isn't aware that the two are one and the same. Now, I absolutely suck at riddles. Like, I'm so bad. I just get too jumbled in my brain, and the answer could literally be right in front of me, and there's no way that I'll get it because I overthink it way too much. You know, the first one is if you look at the numbers on my face, you won't find 13 any place. Well, the answer is, wait for it, a clock. But I would have never guessed that. That feels very easy. Looking back, it makes total sense. But there is just no way on God's green earth that I would have guessed that. There's just no way. Anyway, so he sends all these riddles back and forth and eventually decides to host this massive party to launch his box. Everybody's super excited about it. Everybody wants a box. Everybody's getting a box. They're getting this virtual reality experience, and little do they know that in doing so, they are transferring all of their brain waves and their knowledge over to Edward Nygma. He has now partnered up with Two-Face, and together they have this big elaborate plan that they will allow everybody to go into the box to a secret room at this party where in which the box will reveal their innermost thoughts. And if they invite all of Gotham, then they will have to, at one point, statistically speaking, Batman will go into the said box and his mind will be read and it will reveal to him who is Batman. Well, that just exactly happens in the way that they expect it to. They discover that Batman is Bruce Wayne, and that is where the fun really begins. This party gets a little out of control, and who should save the day but Robin, and he's wearing a lovely tailored suit from Alfred, yet more proof that he wanted this to happen. And of course, Bruce, there's this tumultuous back and forth of, you're not ready. I don't need a partner. And, yes, yeah, I need a partner. This is happening. You don't have a choice. Eventually, Bruce has to cave because what would happen? Well, the Riddler and Two-Face together decide that they are going to do the ultimate torture to Bruce. They are going to ask the burning question of can Bruce Wayne and Batman coexist? So they kidnap the love of Bruce's life, Dr. Chase Meridian. They also kidnap his new partner, Robin, and they put them together in a lair in which they will be both released at the exact same time. Batman will only have enough time to save one of them, in which the other will meet a watery grave. Now, of course, Batman's utility belt and all of his gadgets, they're all going to be able to save the day. But that is really the ultimate question, right? Is if Batman and Bruce Wayne can coexist. Decades later, it is answered via Rachel in The Dark Knight. But at this point, you don't know. We have no idea whether or not they can coexist. At this point, I don't see why not. And I love this movie. To me, this movie really does encapsulate what I love about older superhero movies. I think progressively they get more serious as time has gone on, but I really do enjoy this campy element because you do have the character development. You watch Bruce go through this arc. There's this entire storyline of him going through with Chase where he's got his repressed memories and he's trying to work through that and understand why he's just now remembering things from his parents' death. And he is able to, Chase gives him this Malaysian dream doll, essentially a dream catcher. Towards the end of the movie, he returns it to her. I don't think I need this anymore. And so, there's a really clear story arc where you care just as much about Bruce as you do about the Batman. And then you've got all the fun of Tommy Lee Jones's Two-Face. He's got Debbie Mazar, who's like his henchwoman for his bad side, and then Drew Barrymore, who's his sweet and innocent henchman for his more refined Harvey Dent side. And it's just, he's so much fun to watch. And same with Jim Carrey. I mean, they're both so fun and entertaining to watch. You really do hang on the edge of your seat. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got that love story. It's got the sexiness to it. It's fun. And it's got all the seriousness that comes with the 90s, even an amazing song. This movie, without it, we would never have the absolute golden gem that is the ba ya ya ba 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 ya da da ba ya ya. Baby, rock and peg it to a kiss from the rose on the grave. Ooh, I mean, I won't go on, but it is, oh, it's so good by Seal. And if you ever have 5 minutes to spare, go on YouTube and watch that music video because it is so glorious. It's, Seal and his, satin shirt singing as serious as all get out. And just they show just the perfect clips of Batman and Robin running and Nicole Kidman being sexy. And it's just watching it all in its glory is just amazing. It's amazing. All right, so coming in hot at number four, Avengers Endgame. Now, this is the very last installment of the MCU universe with respect to the original Avengers. I'm sure that there will be more spin-offs, more movies, but in terms of your original crew, this is going to be the last. It is such a juggernaut of a movie. So the movie picks up exactly where Infinity War left off. So quick recap. Thanos gets all of his Infinity Stones and does exactly what he wanted to do. He snaps his fingers, and with that, half of the world is completely wiped out. And just so happens that they wipe out all of your newer characters, right? So your newer Spider-Man played by Tom Holland, your Black Panther, all of the newer characters. So you're left with the original Avengers. And I don't know about you, but that movie left me, I mean, it kind of, I knew that there was another movie coming, because just like with Harry Potter and all of those movies, they take one huge story and they split it into two movies. I knew it was coming, But I left the theater so upset. I was audibly upset about it for days. I talked my husband's ears off about that movie. And so I was really, really upset about it. And you know, Thanos, he's got his whole thing is because he wants to be able to just sit and rest. He feels like humanity has gotten so out of control. And so he thinks the best way to go about healing the world is to really just press the reset button and wipe out half of it so that the rest of the half can get their acts together. So the movie Endgame takes place quite literally 23 days after the events of Infinity War. So half of the universe is completely gone. And, you know, the whole first quarter of the movie is really somber. You know, you've got Captain America who's thinking, you know, even questioning, you know, maybe this is a good thing. And everybody is just really, really sad. And so this original crew attempts to go and fight Thanos. They're thinking, you know, maybe there's a way that we can go back and we can fight him one more time, just us. And they go to space, they find Thanos, and it turns out that Thanos has actually destroyed all of the stones, you know, because that was a part of his plan. He doesn't care about world domination per se. He cares more about rebuilding the world, which I actually have to say is it's an interesting plot. You know, he doesn't have this power trip that a lot of other villains play. So I do have to say, I appreciate that about Thanos. But once they've learned that the Infinity Stones have all been destroyed, they're completely hopeless. There's nothing that they can do. Everybody's pissed. And Thor takes matters into his own hands and offs Thanos. So Thanos is a goner pretty quickly within this movie. Then it jumps to 5 years later. So everybody is tired, they're weary, and I mean, they've been living like this for half a decade. And everybody, honestly, everybody looks like shit. You know, Natasha's hair is like half grown out, so it's got this Miley Cyrus vibe where it's half red and half blonde, and everyone just looks like they've aged 20 years. You know, Thor is now a fat drunkard, and the only one that seems to really be thriving is Tony Stark. So again, what you see in the original Iron Man, you know, he's this loud, cocky playboy guy, and now he is married to Pepper Potts, and they have a beautiful little girl together, and he's a family guy. You know, he's tucking his girl in at night and saying that he, you know, I love you 3000, and he's all about his family. So it turns out that while all of this was happening, Ant-Man was actually living in the quantum realm. So he had plans on going back. Unfortunately, the people that were supposed to bring him back were wiped out when Thanos snapped his hands. So he's been stuck there. He makes his way back. And of course, you know, as anybody would, you know, what the hell is going on? And he hasn't aged a day. He looks fantastic. Everybody else looks disgusting. And he meets with all of the Avengers, gets caught up on what's happened. And he comes up with this idea of a, quote, time heist. It's the idea that they can build a time machine. They can go back in time. Before Thanos has snapped his fingers, they can collect all of the Infinity Stones and right what was wronged and save half of humanity. At first, no one's really into it. They have to go find everybody. You know, they have to go pick up Thor off the floor and, you know, help him go through sobriety. They've got to get everybody together. The main person that they have to convince is Tony Stark. You know, he says from the very beginning, you know, I'm a family man. I actually have things to lose now. And he's just not into it. But they appeal to his better nature in the fact that, you know, there's half of the world is at stake at this point. And so he decides finally to go in and help. And conveniently, he's able to figure out the formula for a time machine in about 24 hours. So they all get together. You know, it's very, you know, Star Trek adjacent. You know, they're all standing together holding hands, and they say together, you know, it's 6 stones, 3 teams, 1 shot. You know, at one point, Iron Man or Tony Stark asks Dr. Strange, who is still alive, how many chances do you think that we have to get this? And he says, there's some odd thousand ways that this could go, but there's only one in which we are successful. So keep that kind of in the back of your mind, is that, we all are kind of thinking about this foreshadowing one situation and when they are in which they are successful. So it gets a little confusing. So I wrote it down in an attempt to hope that I can communicate this without getting too confusing. So they split up again into three different teams. So the first, you have the Hulk, Captain America, and Iron Man, and they go back to New York in 2012. Just so happens that this is around the end of the very first Avengers movie. So what I love about this movie is it kind of pays homage to all of these movies that you have just invested 10 years of your life in. They go back and that iconic scene where they're circling around all of the Avengers, they're all uniting and fighting together. It's just such a cool nod. We've all just invested so much time and energy into watching all of these movies, because you cannot watch this movie without having watching the previous ones, because they spend almost no time playing catch up with you. I mean, it just hits the ground running. You have either watched these movies and you know what's going on, or you're just that poor girlfriend who is dragged here because you know that you're going to be met with a steak dinner afterwards. You have no idea what's going on. So anyway, so it is Hulk, Captain America, and Thor, New York in 2012. Then you have got Asgard in 2013, and that is with Thor and Rocket Raccoon. And then you've got Morag in 2014, and you've kind of got like two, it's one solid team, but like two sub teams. You've got Black Widow and Hawkeye, and then Rhodey and Nebula. So together, they all have different goals to catch different stones. So they all know their mission. Eventually, they're all successful. You've got kind of your first big death within this scene. So at one point, in order to get the Soul Stone, somebody has to be sacrificed. And Black Widow and Hawkeye kind of play this like, like let me do it. No, I want to do it. No, I want to do it. Kind of back and forth. And Black Widow, she doesn't have a family. She doesn't have anybody at home that would be deeply impacted by her death. But Hawkeye does. He's a wife and kid. So eventually, she appeals to his better nature and reminds him of that, in which he allows her to do it. So she is the first really big death of this movie. She takes her life in order to allow Hawkeye to take the Soul Stone back. While this is all happening, the 2014 version of Thanos quickly catches wind of what's happening, and he's like, you know what? Screw it. I was gonna just wipe out half the world, thinking that the remaining half would be willing to rebuild. But if you guys are just going to be miserable about it, I'll just wipe y'all out. So he decides, he has his own ways of time travel. So he decides to travel to the present day in order to fight off what is currently happening. So everybody gets the stones. They all are successful. They all snap back to present day. And at this point, like, there's still an hour left of this movie. One thing that I like about this movie is it's very long. It's 3 hours long, but there's not very many movies I think that can successfully be 3 hours without me ending with a sore ass and just completely stir crazy out of my mind. This movie managed to successfully achieve that. I actually think the 3 hours breeze by very quickly. The only other movie I can think of is Titanic that was able to successfully do that. The movie that I know sucked at this was The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. That movie, people love it. I gotta say, I hated it. It could have lost an hour and potentially I would have liked it, but where do you go off making a 3 hour movie where we all know the ending? We all know what is going to happen. He ages backwards. Whoop-de-doo. Anyway, so Thanos comes back to Earth as, or to present day. As this is happening, they all get the stones. Now, one important piece to know is that these stones, when they're all together, the power is so great that, there's a really high chance that it's just gonna, all of the energy is just gonna consume you and you'll immediately die. from all of the power of these stones. You know, Thanos was badly burned after doing it, and so they decide to give the power of the big snap to bring everybody back to Hulk, because of course he's the bulkiest. So Hulk is able to snap his hands. It does do him a good amount of damage, but he survives, and everything with Thanos takes over so quickly that you're honestly not thinking about anything else. And I mean, it honestly goes from the snap to war within an instant. And everybody is fighting, and it feels very, you know, very somber and serious. You know, no one is doing very well. Thanos has got hundreds of ships, and everybody, you know, they're outnumbered, and you think at one moment that they're going to perish. And all of a sudden you hear in Captain America's ear, "On your left, Cap," and it turns out to be Sam Wilson. And you know in that moment that all is right with the world. Everybody is back, and now they have doubled in size and they are willing to fight. It is on. So as the fighting continues, of course, Thanos is trying to get his hands on that glove, and it turns out that he's eventually able to get his hands on it, but it turns out that the stones are missing from the glove. You realize very quickly that it is because Tony Stark has thieved them. He now has them in his hands, and he takes a look at Doctor Strange, and Doctor Strange lifts up his finger, showing the number one, as if to communicate, "We're here. We have reached that one outcome." And in that moment, they lock eyes. They both know what to do. So Tony takes the Infinity Stones into his possession. And Thanos, before he's realized what's happened, he says, "I am inevitable." And Tony lifts up his hands, reveals that he now has the Infinity Stone. And he says the iconic words, "I am Iron Man." And he snaps his fingers. And just like that, all of Thanos' army and Thanos himself disintegrate into ash, just as half the universe did in the previous films. And everybody gathers around Tony, and everyone is, you know, "We won, you know, Spider-Man, he's so sweet, you know, Mr. Stark, we won, it's okay." And everybody is walking around. Finally, you see Pepper come by, and she looks him in the eye, and she says, "Tony," and she's, at this point, she's talking about her and her daughter. She says, "We're going to be okay." And she tells Tony to rest, and in that moment, Tony dies, and I cannot watch it without crying, because it's so sad. It's just, he has this, like, again, 23 movies. He has this unbelievable arc. You know, he's in all three Iron Man movies. He's in some Captain America movies. He's in all the Avengers. I mean, he is in so many different movies, and in each one, you know, he starts this cocky playboy who, you know, he has a heart of gold, but at the end of the day, he's just condescending and witty. And even in some movies, I dare to say that he is a lot of mouth and not a little heart. But man, Robert Downey Jr. delivered. This movie was so amazing. And might I add, the full circle moment that they bring when they put his character to a close. I mean, the original Iron Man movie ends with Tony Stark saying, "I am Iron Man." And then his last words are the same. It's just, it's moving. I mean, they knew exactly how to make that a moving and impactful moment, because it had to be. Again, this is 10 years of investment, and man, there was not a dry eye in that theater. So then everybody goes home, you know, everybody goes back to living their seemingly normal lives, and they have one last big task for this time machine. So again, everyone's kind of going back to their old lives. Captain America and Sam Wilson and a couple of other characters decide to volunteer themselves to return these Infinity Stones to their rightful locations. And, you know, it can, you know, Hulk explains that it can take as long as a couple seconds, it can take as long as they want it, as they want it to take. And so Captain America goes. At this point, the location is overlooking a beautiful lake, and Captain America goes in his, he's warped back in time or in time to return this Infinity Stone. And then all of a sudden, you notice that there's an old man sitting on a bench looking at the lake. And who would it be but an old Captain America himself, Steve Rogers? So Sam goes up to talk to him. Did something go good? Did something go bad? Trying to figure out how he's made himself here. And he says, "Well, when I returned the stones, I decided to live some of that life that Tony was telling me to get." And you notice he's wearing a wedding ring, and he's talking about how beautiful his life was. And I really love that because in the original Captain America movie, it ends where he's disappointed. He's upset that he's been frozen and he's missed his life. He missed his date with Peggy, and he's missed the opportunity to be able to have his adolescence and to do or be anything other than Captain America. So it's actually a really beautiful full circle scene where you appreciate that Steve has finally gotten that life, and you hope that the person that he's married to is Peggy, and that he finally got his dance. And then who should succeed him but Sam Wilson himself. So that is a fun ending to that movie, is that possibly we could now have a brand new Captain America. So will it be a new franchise? Who knows? But I really, oh, it's just, oh, I love this movie. I love that they pay homage to the older movies. There's a scene at one point where Captain America is wielding Thor's hammer, at the end of an event, the second Avengers movie. They're all at a party and everybody's trying to lift the hammer. It's kind of a fun bit. And the only person that can barely move it is Captain America. So that's kind of a fun nod to that. And it really is the perfect ending. Obviously, I'm devastated about Robert Downey Jr., but that's probably more of a contract thing. Robert Downey Jr. has made it very vocal that he is done. This is, he's not making any more. There's not going to be any kind of time space continuum loophole that they're going to be able to find to bring him back. He is done. So I am sad about that, but I love this movie. There's a lot going on, but they really hit hard with the character development. I mean, you have these amazing moments where you're so excited about what's just happened, and I'm crying over Tony Stark, and then I'm just, oh, my heartstrings are being pulled after seeing what's happening to Steve. And it's such an amazing movie and truly, truly a wonderful bow on 10 years of a really, really fun ride. All right, so moving on to my number three pick, we are going to go with Deadpool. Now, this is a Ryan Reynolds movie in which I have to say they got it right on the money. Finally, a Ryan Reynolds movie that works. Now, if you remember, he actually played Wade Wilson one other time, in X-Men Origins. He was Deadpool. It just, nothing really came of it. He was, again, he was the exact same version of who he is now, just this really cocky guy who was a part of this special mutant force. But the universes are completely unrelated, so that is not mentioned once in this movie. But the movie, of course, it follows around Wade's character. So he is essentially a man for hire. You need somebody to do a hit, he's your man. You need someone to ward off a stalker, he's the guy for you. He will do just about anything. He's an ex-Marine, so he's trying to put his skills to good use. He goes to this bar every night where they have what is called the Dead Pool, where everybody bets on who they think is going to get capped that night. And it's while he's there that he meets the love of his life, Vanessa. She is played by Manera Baccarin, and she is so beautiful. And the two of them have this kind of awkward exchange where they fight over whose life has sucked more. "At least you had a bedroom. I slept in a dishwasher box." And he's, "You had a dishwasher?" I mean, they just kind of go through this kind of weird exchange. And then they end up dating. It shows their whole romance over the course of a year. And it's such a cheeky way. It plays the calendar girl in the background. "I love, I love, I love my calendar girl." It shows them having very passionate sex with each other and all different kinds of holidays. You know, it's Happy Valentine's Day, Happy Thanksgiving, and they're like shoving mashed potatoes all over each other and all different things. And then, of course, during Lent, they're sitting next to each other and completely abstaining. They're reading the newspaper, Happy Lent. And it shows them throughout the year. And during that time, Wade unfortunately discovers that he has a very aggressive kind of cancer. So, you know, Vanessa is really interested in fighting it. He, of course, he wants to, but he isn't convinced that traditional methods are going to be effective. And so his whole motivation is her, right? So he's obsessed with Vanessa. He wants to be able to live happily ever after with her. He is approached by a man who claims that he knows someone who is able to completely cure him, and more than that, also give him special abilities, and that they're interested in that based on his prior military experience. He goes to this place, and it is there that you meet the character named Ajax. Now, again, this movie needs Ryan Reynolds. It is absolutely written for him. He is so funny. You know, this character Ajax is this dramatic British guy, and he's, you know, constantly telling you to, what we're gonna do here is we're gonna subject your body to mass amounts of stress in hopes that the adrenaline will trigger the chemical in your body to help you mutate. And so I'd like to tell you that this isn't gonna hurt, but it is. And maybe that's kind of Australian. I'm not very good with my accents these days, but either way, you know, he's telling Wade, you know, he's gonna be subjected to this intense, terrible pain. And at the time, he's gagged. And so he's, and you think that you expect him to beg for his life. They remove the gag. And what does he say? But you have something in your teeth. And that attitude completely sets the tone for Wade throughout the entire movie. I mean, he just does not take Ajax seriously, which completely pisses him off. And finally, they have so much back and forth, and Ajax hooks him up to this machine that puts his body through such an intense stress that he finally eventually does mutate. Now it takes his very handsome face of Ryan Reynolds and turns him into this completely hideous creature. He looks like he's been burned from head to toe, and but that has also fortunately come with these superhuman skills. You know, he heals very quickly. He is, you know, fast and strong and all the things. So he is able to escape from Ajax's lair, and he makes it his personal mission to hunt Ajax down and kill him. The one advantage that he has right now is that Ajax is absolutely convinced that Deadpool is a goner. And now, to backtrack a little bit, the movie opens with Deadpool. You know, he's sitting on a bridge listening to the I wanna shoot, baby, shoot. Shoop-a-doo. And he looks over at the camera, completely breaks the fourth wall, and he's like, oh, hello there. Bet you're wondering whose balls I had to suck to get in this movie. I mean, this movie is vulgar. It is not safe for work, not safe for the kids. But it kind of takes place almost, I would say, about halfway into the movie. And then, so at this point, he's looking for Ajax, and then everything rewinds back to the very beginning. So at this point, you're quickly brought back to where the movie opened. You know, he's trying to hunt down Ajax. And while this is happening, a couple of characters from Charles Xavier's school, you have got Warlord and Negasonic Teenage Warhead, that try to track down Deadpool. You know, they're not happy with the way that he's leaving their town in a mess. And eventually, they really do want him to join his team. Now, it's at this point that Ajax realizes that Wade is not only alive, but he is out to get him. And so he decides to go to this bar where the said Deadpool is located and track down Wade. He sees a picture of Wade and Vanessa, quickly realizes that that is going to be the best way to get him is to use Vanessa as bait. So that's exactly what he attempts to do. Wade, who catches wind of this, tries to track down Vanessa, but he is too late. Ajax gets there first, which, by the way, Side note, Wade learns that Ajax is not his real name. It's actually Francis, which is amazing just because, again, that's just one other thing that he gives him shit about. So, pretty much throughout this portion of the movie, he is now referring to Ajax as Francis. And so the movie finally closes. You know, there's an epic battle royale between Francis and his team and Deadpool and his, and, you know, he's fighting to be able to save Vanessa, who's in danger at this point. She's been used as bait. And of course, Deadpool is successful. He saves Vanessa, reveals his identity, and Vanessa comes at him with a hilarious and vulgar line. You know, he's obviously expecting her to be disgusted by him, and she says instead, you know, this looks like the perfect face for me to sit on. It ends in such a great full circle way, just like it started. Now, I love this movie. Actually, when you really break down the plot, it's super simple. You know, it's all cookie cutter almost, if you will. There's a simple villain, a very simple plot, but I feel like that's there intentionally. You know, there's not any kind of gimmick there. It's because Deadpool is the star. The character is the movie. But so this movie is so fun to watch. I mean, it's hilarious how self-deprecating it is. Not just Deadpool as himself, but also Ryan Reynolds as himself. You know, as he's about to go in to form his mutation, you know, he says, "Just don't make my suit green or animated," which is, of course, a stab at his character in the Green Lantern. And, you know, he's vulgar, he's distasteful, but it works because he's also lovable. I mean, that is to me the reason why you have the love story with Vanessa, is to be able to show the layers that he has. It humanizes him. This movie is just so well done. I mean, they really thought of everything. The director and Ryan Reynolds worked together in every essence of the word. You know, with Deadpool's mask, for example, they made the decision that they needed to shoot everything twice because the mask is so thick, it really cannot capture all of Deadpool's facial expressions and responses to be able to really bring that character to life. So they filmed everything once with the mask on and then everything with the mask off so that they'd be able to go back and regenerate it along with all of Ryan Reynolds' facial expressions, which was so genius. I love what they were able to do. And the two of them together also, they gunned really, really hard that Deadpool would be able to break that fourth wall. Studio was not down for it. Nobody wanted to do it. You know, breaking that fourth wall can really be a huge hit or miss, but they wanted to do it because, again, it's not just a superhero movie, it's also a comedy, so they have to be able to make fun of themselves a little bit. And so they just decided to go for it, and to me it worked. This movie hits in all the right spots. It is so funny, yet it's exciting to watch. They really are able to marry the two genres together of superhero and comedy, and they created a hit. All right, so moving on to my number two pick, and that is Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, I had actually never heard of these comics before. They apparently were kind of a C-rated comic, but they picked it up. It was a wild card, and I think it did so great. So this was Chris Pratt's re first real deviation into something serious, and everybody knows him from Parks and Rec, and he's been in several movies where he's just kind of the goofy friend, and he gunned hard for this movie. He really, really rallied for it, and he made a commitment to really transform his body in order to play it. You know, because if you can remember, he was, you know, I wouldn't have called him fat per se, but he definitely wasn't as ripped as he is in this movie. I mean, he really did the work. So the movie revolves all around Chris Pratt's character, that is Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord. So the movie first takes place on Earth. He's a young boy. He's about to lose his mom. And the only thing that he really has left of his mother is a Walkman, because, again, this movie takes place in the 80s. And all he has of his mom is a Walkman with, you know, his greatest hits, Volume 1. And he says goodbye to his mom. And then that scene really ends, and it completely picks up with very little explanation to in space. And you've got Peter Quill, it's about 25, 6 years later. And so he's now an outlaw. And the movie really truly opens with him, skipping water and running around in this abandoned planet, and all to come and get your love. And right when that happens, you're the hey, hey, you. My husband and I, we saw this in theaters. We both looked at each other, and you can feel it. I mean, there is something about the soundtrack that can really make or break a movie. And when this happened, we looked at each other. We knew this movie was gonna slap. And so, Peter, while he's in this abandoned planet, he finds an orb that he has to deliver to Yondu. So Yondu is essentially a loan shark that Peter is working for, and he finds this orb. He gets into a little bit of a pickle trying to get out, but instead of returning the orb to Yondu, he decides to take it and sell it himself. This infuriates Yondu. Yondu immediately makes the command to put a bounty on him. So that kind of sets the tone for who Peter is. He's a scavenger. He's only looking out for number one. So he goes to a different planet where he plans to pawn it. And it's there that you run into Rocket Raccoon, who is literally a raccoon, a talking, walking raccoon that has absolutely what I would call little man syndrome. You find out pretty early on, anybody that calls him cute or rodent, or he's clearly very insecure. But the truth is, the facts are facts. He's adorable. But he's played by Bradley Cooper, voiced by Bradley Cooper, I should say. And he is with Groot. So Groot is this big tree that quite literally can only say, "I am Groot." And he can say it in all different kinds of ways and voice fluctuations, but it's always going to be the same. "I am Groot." Now, he is voiced by Vin Diesel. Now, this character, it has to be said, so Vin Diesel, when this movie came out, it was actually shortly after the death of Paul Walker. And Groot, Vin Diesel went on to say that playing this character was actually incredibly cathartic for him, because you find out very quickly that Groot is a very healing character. He's very good. He kind of has an innocence to him that none of the other characters have. So it's I kind of like knowing that when I watch it, because it just adds an extra layer of charm and sweetness to the character. So they too are scavengers. They see that there's a bounty on Peter Quill, and so they decide that they're going to capture him. Now, while this is all happening in a different planet, a bad guy named Ronan, and he's this purple bad guy, he's got this like black shit on his face, and no one ever explains it. Like, they actually paint it on him, and that's very frustrating to me, because it's like, why is it on your face? Why are you, and it's not like it's a birthmark. You are purposely putting it on your face with absolutely no explanation. It's not sunny where you're going. You don't need to reflect the sunlight. But anyway, so he is talking with Gamora and Nebula. Now, they're sisters. Gamora is played by Zoe Saldana, and Nebula is played by Karen Gilliam. Now, I hate her voice, Karen Gilliam. In real life, I love it. I think it's very pleasant. She's Scottish. She has a very soft Scottish accent. But in this movie, she talks like this, like very monotone and very serious. And there's absolutely no fluctuation whatsoever. I hate listening to that. So she, anyway, so she attempts to go to the same planet to retrieve the orb, because that's really what they have their eye on. They could care less about Peter Quill. They want the orb. But Gamora has convinced Ronan that she should go instead. And so she is successful in convincing him she goes. So at the exact same time that Rocket and Groot are capturing Peter, Gamora comes in, swoops in, starts attacking Peter to try to take the orb as well. So they're all fighting, and in the process, the police force of this planet arrests all of them and throws them all in jail. And it's important to note that they all hate each other at this point. I mean, the only people who are partners are Rocket and Groot, but everybody else, like, they're completely disinterested in each other. So they're in jail, and half the people in jail want to see Gamora dead because, important side note, is that Gamora and Nebula are daughters of Thanos. Yes, the exact same Thanos from Avengers Endgame. This is kind of one of the big introductions to Thanos. I'm pretty sure that he's introduced prior, but this is one of the really, really big pieces where he's pretty pivotal to the storyline. So it's in jail that they meet Drax. Now, he is the final member of the Guardians. He is in prison and he has this desperate desire to kill Ronan. Ronan has murdered his wife and his daughter, and so he is just filled with rage and wants to vindicate his family. Now, they all decide because they have one common enemy, they have one common goal, they're all going to band together and break out of jail. You know, Rocket has got this plan of all the things he needs. He's like, you know, I need some tape. I need a prosthetic leg. I need this. I need that. And so he's able to gather all the things he needs, including the prosthetic leg, and break out of jail. Now, at this point, they still openly all hate each other, but they've just escaped jail, you know, certain death. And so they're excited. They're all celebrating. Everybody's gambling. And Peter and Gamora go off and listen to some music. They start to bond over music. And one of my all-time favorite parts in this entire movie, they're listening to the music together. And Gamora, you know, she's never really heard music before. And so Peter asks her to dance. She thinks it's a ridiculous request. And his response is, "Well, on my planet, there's a legend about people like you. It's called Footloose. And in it, a great hero named Kevin Bacon teaches an entire city full of people with sticks up their butts that dancing is the greatest thing there is." And oh my gosh, I love the nostalgia. Actually, Kevin Bacon came out with a quote because he had no idea that this was happening, right? So his quote was, "Well, I mean, there was mention in Guardians of the Galaxy, which I thought was pretty amazing. I really didn't know anything about it when I went in and sat in the movie theater. Somebody had just said to me, 'Have you seen that movie?' And I said, 'No, I'm going, but I haven't seen it yet.' I'm sitting in the movie theater and I'm thinking, wow, that's some shout out." So shout out to Kevin Bacon. I mean, it is, there's a reason why we call it 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, right? I mean, he is, at one point, he was the goat, especially in the 80s. So, one thing I love about this movie is all of the amazing nostalgic nods. I mean, would I truly be a millennial if I wasn't into nostalgia? So, they take the orb to the collector. Now, it's at this point that the collector opens up the orb and reveals that what is actually inside is the purple Infinity Stone. So, yes, this is the exact same Infinity Stone. One of them that is used to destroy half the universe in Infinity War and then eventually restore it in Endgame. So, this is one of the first introductions to the Infinity Stones. I mean, they go back as far as Captain America, but this is the first sight of the purple Infinity Stone, and that is the Power Stone. So eventually Ronan catches up to them and they attempt to fight and but you know, unfortunately their ship is hit and ends up going down, and in an act of martyrdom, Groot pulls off these branches, these huge branches, and in his tree trunk, and he completely forms this protective ball against all of the Guardians, because you know, through all of their trials and tribulations, you know, at this point, they've actually become friends. You know, there's a scene earlier where Drax is explaining that he likes everybody. You know, he's like, "You all are my friends. I've never had friends. Peter Quill, you are my friend. This rodent is my friend. This dumb tree is my friend. This green whore is my friend." You know, they have established that they like each other at this point. So Groot is sacrificing himself. And Rocket Raccoon runs up and is like, no, Groot, what are you doing? You'll die." And Groot, you think you know exactly what he's going to say, but instead of saying, "I am Groot," he says, "We are Groot." And he ends up saving the Guardians, but killing himself in the process. So Groot is, unfortunately, he's gone. And it was so sad. I absolutely loved Groot. I mean, I think for like a month after this movie, I was just like, "I'm Groot. I'm Groot." I mean, I just was one of those basic bitches that just wouldn't stop obsessing over Groot. So I digress. They are now back on land and Groot is gone. They're fighting Ronan, and Ronan has managed to get himself the purple Infinity Stone. It is meant for Thanos, but he has decided, just like Peter Quill ditched Yondu in the beginning, he's going to ditch Thanos and take all of the power for himself. Now, one thing that I absolutely love about Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord, in this movie is that there's this big climactic scene and you don't know what's going to happen. It's between, you've got Peter Quill up against Ronan. He's got the Infinity Stone. You have no idea where it's going to turn. And all of a sudden, Peter Quill just starts singing, "Ooh, child, everything's gonna be brighter." And I have to say, I think that that would probably be my only weapon as well. I mean, I think that the only thing that, only hope that I would have is to be a decoy or some kind of distraction in order for someone else to come in and suit the day. I mean, my husband and I have already established that if there's ever a zombie apocalypse, like, I'm fucked. Like, there's nothing that I'm gonna be able to do to save myself unless somehow I can latch on to him and one of our particular friends in Finley that we know would be able to survive. Shout out to Deb, you know who you are. So I digress. Peter's plan works. He's able to be a distraction, letting the other guardians swoop in. They are successful in destroying Ronan. They have restored peace within the galaxies. And so the movie comes to a close where they decide that this is what they're going to do now. They're officially guardians of the galaxy. And so what's next? Are we going to get into a little bit of trouble? Are we going to do some good? Are we going to do some bad? And Peter gives them the answer, a little bit of both. And with that, they fly off into the galaxy, leaving Peter to finally discover volume two of his mom's greatest hits, which brings the entire movie completely full circle. I love this movie. I love how fresh they made it. I mean, it is so much fun to watch. The music is amazing. Again, the nostalgia piece makes it so fun. And I love that it's really hard to make a team movie. I mean, Avengers, they were able to successfully do it, but this is a movie where they start off as a team. The Avengers took several movies where you had to give all kinds of backstories in order to get to that first Avengers movie. This leaves very little room for any kind of character development. So they knew what they were doing when they added in the fun music and the comedy, that they needed something to be able to hook everybody in enough to allow the character development to naturally come once they were united as a team. All right. So finally, my top superhero movie of all time is The Dark Knight. I love this movie. I saw it when it came out in theaters. I went to the midnight showing with some of my friends from college, and I have seen it so many times. Every single time I watch it, I just get more and more invested. This movie was so well done. I absolutely love it. Now, what sets this movie apart from all of the remaining four, and from quite frankly, a lot of these movies, first and foremost, this is the only DC movie that I have listed. Secondly, this movie is really serious. I think the closest second with respect to a movie that is serious would be Endgame, but still, that movie has a lot of laughs and a lot of fun along the way. This movie has very, very little of that. This is a very serious movie. This was directed by Christopher Nolan and starring Christian Bale as the Batman. Now, I love having this conversation with people of like, who is your favorite Batman of all time? Like, rank them. Rank your favorite Batman for me. I gotta start with Val Kilmer. Obviously, Batman Forever is on my top five. My argument for why Val Kilmer is better than Michael Keaton, you could probably argue that perhaps Michael Keaton makes for a more entertaining Batman. But Val Kilmer is a better Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is supposed to be a suave, kind of cocky playboy, and that is just not Michael Keaton. I mean, when I look at Michael Keaton, I see Beetlejuice. Then I would say Michael Keaton is a close second because he's the OG. So you got to pay him the respects. Then you'd have Christian Bale. Now I don't like his voice, the "Where is she?" I don't really like that. I mean, I appreciate that he needs to disguise his voice because that's something that's never truly explained in any of the others. Then I guess for the remaining two, by default, I'm going to go ahead and pick Ben Affleck. I was not very impressed with his rendition. I just felt him to be a little too dark and too brooding, but not in a way that felt earned to me. You know, you at least get to watch the arc of Christian Bale. You know, he's kind of cheeky and really hopeful in the beginning, and then he slowly declines into becoming this darker character. And so, you know, this brooding and depressed Batman, I didn't feel like it was earned for me. I don't really feel that bad for you. And then he just totally snaps out of it the moment that he realizes that both he and Superman, their mommies, are the same name. I mean, I don't know. It didn't do it for me. Then I would say by far the absolute worst Batman ever is none other than George Clooney. I appreciate that they were trying to make it campy and he was really at the highlight of his stardom. But man, talk about an empty and void Batman. Sure, he's a good Bruce Wayne, but you bring absolutely nothing to the Caped Crusader. I mean, you might as well let James Cameron CGI you into the movie and save the budget having to pay your salary. So moving on. So the movie opens and the heist is probably one of the coolest openings of any movie. I mean, it is flawless. There's absolutely no explanation whatsoever. There's just all these men in these clown suits and they're robbing a bank and there's all different kinds of characters and it is a complete domino effect in which one clown completes a task, a different clown offs him, leaving the pool of money to get bigger and bigger and bigger for each clown until eventually they end up with one singular clown, and that is the Joker. Which, side note, the timing for that. So they all take off on, or Joker takes off on a bus and then pulls out of the bank and lines up perfectly with all of these other school buses. So you're very quickly introduced to the character of Joker. Joker is played by Heath Ledger. Now you could play who your favorite Joker is as well. I think that that is an equally fun game to play. I would, without a doubt, though, this is the absolute best Joker of all time. It doesn't get any better. He brings humor. He brings, strangely, this amount of depth and likability, but he also is true to the Joker's nature and the fact that he is just an agent of chaos. All he really wants is anarchy. There's no agenda other than just to watch the world burn. And so the movie really focuses around that relationship, that push and pull between the Joker and Batman. So then you're quickly introduced to Harvey Dent. Harvey is now dating Rachel, so there's a little bit of a personal edge there with Bruce, but he is the new district attorney of Gotham. He has been declared Gotham's White Knight, and Bruce is very excited about this. He feels like Harvey is the savior that Gotham needs. You know, Batman has to break rules in order to get things done, in order to create his own justice. Yet Harvey is able to do it the right way, the way it's supposed to be intended. He can actually get criminals off the street and introduce change that is positive and get Gotham back to a harmonious place. So they're all out having dinner together. Bruce is talking about how he wants to throw this amazing fundraiser and how he really believes in his work. And there's this amazing line that Harvey says while they're eating at dinner because they're talking about this, the push and pull of getting people off the streets and how sometimes, you know, sometimes you do have to break the rules in order to get things done. And Harvey says, "Okay, so fine. You either die hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain." And that is absolutely foreshadowing of what is to come. Now, again, the Joker is only concerned with trying to figure out who the Batman is, but along the way, you get to see his journey. So he gets involved with all of these Gotham mobsters. He tries to take their money. I mean, you are introduced to his storyline, and it's so amazing. He goes in and robs some of the mobsters, tries to take their money, and the like head honcho goes in. You think you can just come on in here and take all of our money? Joker just looks at him. Yeah. And it's hilarious. And he goes into this whole trope, which comes up multiple times. You want to know how I got these scars? And every time it's a different story. And you very quickly learn that he is trying to get everybody to band together to realize that they have a common enemy, and that is the Batman. So the Joker goes on a vendetta to prove to everyone that the world is chaotic. People are inherently bad. They might seem good, but you get them in the right circumstances, and everybody is going to be bad. He basically believes what Freud once said, which is like the only driving factors for people are sex and fear. And he fully believes that. So he tries to spark fear into everybody by saying that the Batman has to reveal himself. If he doesn't reveal himself, then people will die. And he does make good with his promise. So the film continues, and Harvey is able to find a legal loophole which imprisons all of these mobsters. So he is able to get all these criminals off the street. He is widely celebrated for doing so. And later at this big party, the one that Bruce had promised to throw him, the Joker makes his grand entrance, and now all of the plot lines are intertwined. So the story continues. He decides to really target Harvey in order to do this. So he ends up capturing both Harvey and Rachel. They're both put into different locations, and they're both hooked up to these oil drums, and they each have a speaker phone that are connected to the other so that they can communicate with one another. Now, the Joker provides the coordinates for both locations. He doesn't correctly specify who's at who, but he does make it very clear that there isn't enough time to save them both. Batman is going to have to choose. Unfortunately for Rachel, they find Harvey, but not before a massive explosion goes off, and it ends up that a big part of Harvey's face is completely burned off. And of course, you guessed it by his name, he becomes none other than Two-Face. And I feel like they did actually keep it relatively under wraps. So Harvey is in the hospital, he's injured, and he's at a complete fork in the road. He has to decide who he wants to be. Does he want to continue this journey of being a white knight, or does he want to go down a dark path and seek revenge? Now, this plot line actually really reminds me, it has Star Wars Episode 3 adjacent vibes. When Anakin is super worried about Padme, he ends up completely, going off the deep end and, killing young Jedis and all the things to protect her. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of that, where you have someone that started off so good and so pure, and by stripping them away of what they love most, they prove Joker's exact point, which is that people truly are capable of this insidious evil if given the right circumstances and the right triggers. It is later, though, that that is completely disproven as a whole. The Joker takes, he's got a boat full of prisoners and then a boat full of civilians, and each have the detonator switch to the other. And if they don't make a decision, then they'll both go off. But it turns out that they decide not to negotiate, not to do it, which completely disproves Joker's theory as a whole. So the your hope for humanity is a little bit reinstilled. But I love this movie so much because it gave superhero movies permission to take themselves seriously. I think without this, we wouldn't have the blueprint for some of the other more serious movies that we have, with Endgame, for example, that ended on such a beautiful note. That might not have happened had there not been such an amazing success with Dark Knight. And I love how they question the formula. I mean, they really do take it down to a psychological level of the Joker trying to prove his theory. And I love it. I love Harvey, how he truly does just completely, just like, again, with the Star Wars vibes, just like Palpatine is able to just control Anakin like putty in his hands. The Joker is the exact same way with Harvey. And so Harvey has completely, he's a different person now. His only care is getting revenge. So at this point, he's got Commissioner Gordon and his kids. And, he's telling Gordon, hug your son and tell him, I want you to tell him that it's going to be okay. Tell him that he's going to be safe and lie to him. And of course, Batman comes swooping in. He saves the day. And he and Gordon have this big conversation. And in it, Batman makes it perfectly clear that no one can know about this, that nobody can know that Harvey has done this. No one can know that this is how he met his demise. And because Gotham needs him, Gotham needs their White Knight. And so he decides to take the fall for Gotham City. He decides to absorb what has happened and take the blame for it because he knows that it's not about being a superhero that gets accolades, but rather that he actually be what Gotham needs. And Commissioner Gordon says it perfectly. He's the hero Gotham deserves, but not the hero it needs right now. And that's all that needs to be said. It's so perfect. And again, I love this movie. I love how it's able to explore the psychology behind good versus evil, because again, that's really at the core of these movies, right? Is that fight between good and evil. Like I was saying earlier, the superhero movies just hyperbolize that, but they were able to take this and fully dissect it to a newer level and do so in a way that is so badass and so fun to watch. And the Joker will always go down in time as the ultimate supervillain because at the end of the day, nothing is scarier than a man who has absolutely no agenda. He just wants to fuck shit up. It's just, oh, it's so good. It is so good. This movie actually won Heath Ledger the Oscar. This also just so happened to be his last really high-profile movie before his untimely death. And this movie will always go down in time as the ultimate superhero movie. Okay, so that was longer than I had anticipated. There's a lot of ground to cover. These movies have a lot of detail, but I am ready to talk Wonder Woman 1984. So, as you can imagine, this movie takes place in 1984. So it is quite the departure from the first movie. So the original movie takes place during World War I, where she meets her the love of her life, Steve, played by Chris Pine. And that movie, to give you some background context, it ends with him sacrificing himself to save the world. It ends with a quote along the lines of, "I can save today, but you can save the world." So before the official movie begins, you see a clip back in Diana's original homeland, where her and all the other demigods live, and they're having what I can only describe as an American Ninja Warrior moment. They're going through this very integral obstacle course, and Diana finds she falls off her horse, so seemingly she will lose, but she finds a shortcut and ends up getting into the lead. But before she can officially win, her aunt, played by the amazing Robin Wright, picks her up and takes her out of the race and explains to her that there are no shortcuts in life and nobody can build anything off of lies. Now, I mentioned that because that really sets the tone for the movie, right? That's going to be the overall moral. So, again, this movie takes place in 1984, so some time has passed. Steve is long gone, and Diana looks great. She hasn't aged a day, and she is working at the Smithsonian. She is an archaeologist, and it's there that she is introduced to Barbara, who is played by Kristen Wiig. Now, Barbara is the antithesis of Diana. She's awkward and I actually find Kristen Wiig very attractive, but they do a good job of making her homely in this movie. And, she's completely enchanted by Diana. She thinks Diana is just absolutely gorgeous. And so, she absolutely just idolizes her. So, as this storyline is going on, you notice that there is a guy all over the TV. He has these big time Gordon Gekko vibes, and his name is Max Lord, and he is played by Pedro Pascal, better known as the Mandalorian. Now, he is this like very 80s, like if you can dream it, you can be it kind of guy. And he's all about trying to motivate people. You very quickly learn that he is a crook. He has this very fancy office, but you open up the doors and there's absolutely nothing inside. So his character story is kind of paused for a little later, but while Diana and Barbara are working at their office in the Smithsonian, they come across this very special fancy stone. It's made of citrine, and it turns out that this stone is enchanted. There is the ability to grant wishes. And of course, nothing is for free, so neither are these wishes. And so, of course, Diana is concerned that if this stone gets into the wrong hands, then a destructive wish could be made that changes the course of time, space, and life as they know it. So that's really the general plot of the movie. There's a lot of fun turns along the way. I have to admit, if I'm being completely honest, I had a lot of fun watching this movie. It is fun. I love watching Diana. I mean, talk about girl power. I love seeing a female in a strong, powerful role, and she is absolutely breathtaking. Kristen Wiig always brings a fun element. I'm very proud that she's in a role that allows her to be funny but also serious. And I love Pedro Pascal. I mean, anything that he's in. I mean, even him in Game of Thrones. I mean, watching that guy's face get squished, and I love him. And I had a lot of fun watching this movie. You gotta watch it. You have to watch it. You're gonna have fun. Now, I think the first Wonder Woman was a lot more serious. There was little to no camp in that movie at all. I really think that they were trying to go for that kind of Man of Steel, Dark Knight vibe. And they hit it right on the money. This movie, however, has a lot more camp. It, to be fair, can you really do any movie that is based in the 80s without some level of camp? I mean, half the movie is just fun to watch because of the clothes and the music. I do think that there is an element of camp in this movie. My biggest critique with this movie is that the writing honestly is a little lazy. I can't always get behind a movie where the plot doesn't feel very consistent. It feels choppy. And so that is my shtick with this movie, is that I wish that they put a little bit more effort into the actual writing so that the storyline flowed a little bit better. And maybe put a little bit more focus into that as opposed to all of the fun effects and the fancy outfits. But nonetheless, I really had a lot of fun watching this movie. If we're comparing this movie to other movies in the DC universe, this definitely is superior. I mean, there have been so many that have just completely like, wah, wah. I mean, obviously Green Lantern being one of them. I think that the Superman movies just don't slap for me. It's sad but true. There is something, I don't know why DC hasn't been able to figure it out. I mean, Marvel has had 23 movies. I mean, they have had so many movies, just Avengers alone. That's not even counting all the X-Men movies. I mean, they have somehow figured the formula out in DC. It's almost like that Marvel is the kind of the popular guy in high school that everybody loves. All the girls want to date, and all the guys want to be friends with, and he always throws the winning touchdown. And sure, you know, maybe he's a little cocky, but at the end of the day, he's like that because it's earned. You know, he's got the grades and he's got the talent and the smile. And DC is just kind of over there like a sweaty tryhard, trying so hard to be his friend. You know, he's sitting on the bench just like, hey, I'm ready to come in. Want to put me in the game? Put me in the game, coach. And you know, and then the second you do that, he scores for the wrong team. So I don't know. I think this movie is fun. It is worth a watch. But at the end of the day, I have to be honest, it's going to be a movie that I don't think is going to hold up. Regardless, hit me up and let me know what you think. All right, guys, we did it. We did it again. I hope that you had as much fun listening and reliving all these movies as I did. And as always, I'm going to ask you to rate, review, and subscribe for more episodes. Thank you all so much for bearing with me and sticking it out to the end. And hey, we'll see you next week.